Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Patterson, and today I'm speaking with Thurka Sangamurthy and Karen Kroger about their new book, Rapid Ethnographic Assessments, a Practical Approach and Toolkit for Collaborative Community Research. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Can you start off by telling us a little bit about each of you and how this book developed for you two?
Karen and I met a long time ago, what seems like a long time ago now. We met in 2009 at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I began there as a postdoctoral fellow right after completing my PhD work. And I was a fellow in the Division of Sexually Transmitted Disease Prevention. And I had a fellowship to work in sexually transmitted diseases and sexual health more broadly. And Karen was actually assigned as my supervisor at that time. And I was really excited because we had so much in common. We were both cultural anthropologists. We had trained in very traditional PhD programs. We had both conducted long-term sort of ethnographic work. And we had very similar interests, particularly around HIV and sexual health more broadly. And we were really focused on health outcomes and how certain people were more vulnerable than others and thinking through those kinds of ideas. And Karen took me under her wing. We did a lot of work at the CDC around designing work that would help us really think through social and structural factors that really were some of the root causes of poor sexual health or sexually transmitted disease outbreaks. And that's really how we thought about this particular method that we were engaged in and really trying to kind of bring it to light at the CDC and in our division. And it did have a long history of that, but we were trying to get more traction for it. I don't know, Karen, if you have anything to add with regard to that.
Sure. So I was already at CDC. I had actually done the same postdoctoral fellowship that Thurka did back in 2001 and 2, and then gone off for a couple of years and come back to CDC in 2004, and was in the Global AIDS program for a number of years before I moved to the Division of STD Prevention. So I had worked with some other folks at CDC who had been doing rapid assessment, both in the international public health arena and also domestically. But when Thurka arrived, it was kind of like we had a critical mass to work together and actually develop this and kind of do more training around it and go out and do some really interesting work. And what Thurka is alluding to is that, you know, rapid assessment in some form or fashion has been around for a long time. A lot of people think that rapid assessment work started in the 1970s when anthropologists were working internationally in international health and development. There was a need for working in settings that might be resource poor or might not, where there might not be a lot of data available on a given problem, that rapid assessment was a kind of a tool that was developed to quickly gather data in local communities and then be able to use it to impact a program or make a change quickly, rather than something that would take a couple of years, as you know, a lot of kind of more traditional anthropological studies do, which incidentally, both of us have also done. But anyway, so that's kind of a little bit of the background. We started working together at CDC in 2009 and kind of took off from there.
You know, I think what's really important for us was that when we were working in government public health, you know, we really talked a lot about how we were often walking a fine line between sort of how we were trained in ethnographic work as well as in anthropology. So really sort of trying to use these really critical principles and methods of traditional ethnography. But working in these settings, we were also really well aware how we needed to use that kind of training to really generate more timely information for things that were emergent and really needed sort of quick turnaround. And so ethnography is very slow, quote unquote, slow in a sense that it takes much longer periods of time. And so we were really trying to kind of think through how this could be sort of adapted to these kinds of settings where critical information and timely information was really important. So we had a lot of conversations. We were also really committed to training others in this method. And we did a number of, Karen's been there much longer and had done far more extensive training of local health department staff. We also did trainings together for CDC staff. And we really sort of understood that there was a need for this. We've also done some trainings for anthropologists at conferences and so forth. And when I left for an academic position, I also found myself thinking through how to adapt this for students as well, graduate in particular, but also undergraduate students, not only from anthropology, but other sort of fields. And so when a publishing opportunity came up, you know, I talked to Karen about it and thought this was really a good way for us to be able to think through some of these things that we had been thinking about for about a decade and how to get that out.
So can you begin by sort of defining some terms and concepts that are important for our understanding of the method in general, and then some of the key principles?
Sure. I'm just going to start, and I think, you know, Karen will sort of help me fill in some of these gaps. So, you know, Karen sort of nicely pointed out that rapid ethnographic assessments, we think, really emerged sometime in the 1970s, particularly in international health and development, particularly in low resource settings where few existing data, you know, were available. And there was really a need for a rapid response to solving some of these issues, particularly around health as well as international development, where there was a huge need for affected communities to play a role in formulating some of these solutions. So some of the critical sort of characteristics of rapid ethnographic assessments that I think that we really try to focus on is that it's an approach to data collection that's really based in qualitative methods. And we try to emphasize sort of an ethnographic kind of sensibility and orientation to this kind of work. So that's really critical. It's an approach that's really can be used for a variety of different purposes. So exploratory or formative research, programmatic or needs assessment, as well as rapid response activities as well. So there are a few key things here. It's really based on ethnographic principles that, you know, we can talk a little bit about that as well. It's rapid. That's the critical key component of this. And this is why it's very different from traditional ethnographic work, as well as some other kinds of research methods. Rapid meaning that it has small non-probability samples and it's very focused in terms of its research questions. It's also very team-based. It's entirely team-based. And so there is one of the major characteristics that it's focused really on interdisciplinary team-based data collection and analysis. It is very specific in a sense that it's really designed to bring about practical, actionable outcomes. to really sort of improve upon or to help people understand where programs are and how policies may be needed to, you know, in terms of affecting change. It's also really focused. One of the things that we really focus on in the book is that REAs or rapid ethnographic assessments are really sort of critical tools for engaging communities and in particularly in trying to shift power dynamics that are inherently embedded in traditional research processes.
Yeah, I think the only other thing I would add to that is that, and I think you touched on it a little bit, is that, you know, we always tried when we were doing our trainings with fellows at CDC or with other staff members or also out, you know, in the field and at conferences to kind of emphasize this idea of ethnography being based on kind of learning from people rather than studying people. So not to diminish any other kinds of, you know, methods or work that are out there, but that we're not going out to do a survey and kind of try to extract information from people. We're really trying to work in partnership with them to really learn from them, from their perspective, what they think is going on with whatever the problem is, you know, what they think are the most important things for us to know about a particular situation. So it's just kind of a different approach, I think, in terms of just trying to emphasize the ethnographic aspects of this approach to data collection.
So you've touched on a few ways in which this or how this method is useful. So I was wondering if you could give us a few specific examples of when REA is useful and the key considerations researchers should really keep in mind for using it.
So I think, you know, one of the things that going back to emphasizing that we're trying to, this is an approach in which we are trying to gather information for practical purposes. So information for action. And the other important point I think it is to kind of keep in mind is that qualitative methods are about achieving depth and insight, not breadth. So we're not looking necessarily to measure or to determine the magnitude or the frequency of a problem or an issue, but rather to try to understand things like motivations, processes, systems, and practices. So trying to get at details and description. So rapid ethnographic assessment can be particularly useful when little is known about a problem or a problem is just emerging, or, you know, as I said, when we need just a better, more robust understanding of what's going on. It's also very useful in terms of being able to make adjustments to programs or services. So if you're trying to understand, for example, in a program why your clients have dropped off, you know, is there a particular reason? It may be very helpful just to go out and be able to talk to people, gather some data, and then make some adjustments to the programs. If a population that you're trying to reach is moving around and you need to know how to actually reach them in the community, it may be useful to do an REA for that. And also, as Thurka mentioned earlier, when we want to or we need to really engage or involve with the local community because perhaps the population is hidden and hard to reach. So those are some examples of when rapid assessment or REA might be particularly useful.
So I want to just add that, you know, we think rapid ethnographic assessments are really wonderful and should be used more, but people do need to also emphasize that not everything can be really approached through a rapid ethnographic assessment. So really careful consideration needs to be made to see whether this is really the right approach for the kinds of information that might be needed. So as Karen said, you know, if you're really thinking about sort of understanding the degree or magnitude of the problem, this is really not the right approach. When population level analyses are needed, this may also not be the right approach. But obviously, lessons and information that are learned from rapid ethnographic assessments can be much more applicable to other programs, places, or populations. So it can be really utilized for understanding how certain kinds of issues can unfold in other places as well. You also need to consider things like time and resources. And so those things might really configure whether or can really sort of really help you sort of think through whether the REA is the right approach. And then so those are also things that really should be taken into consideration when you're considering whether the rapid assessment is the best approach for what you need. And oftentimes we don't think about things like that, like time or resources, but here it does really make a difference.
So you dig into sampling strategies in your book. Can you explain what those are and give us an example?
The objective, I think Karen and I touched on this a little bit. The key objective in rapid ethnographic assessments, much like the key objective in qualitative ethnographic research, is really to understand local perspective and categorize these kinds of issues based on those. So oftentimes when we think about sampling in ethnographic as well as in qualitative work, we really are trying to reach saturation or theoretical saturation. So it's not simply about how many people that you interview. That's not necessarily really the critical focus, but it's really trying to understand, you know, are you really understanding the phenomena that you are looking at? Have you learned enough about it? And so it's really important to think through saturation as typically something that's reached when no new information is really forthcoming from additional data collection. And so it's not just about, again, the number of interviews. It's really about whether you have deep understanding of the problem in itself. And so the preference is really to cover fewer cases in much more in-depth ways than it is to be much broader in a much more cursory manner. And so the focus in trying to think about sampling when it comes to interviews is really including a variety of different participants who are really known to have in-depth knowledge or direct experience in the areas that are being looked at in the rapid ethnographic assessment. So it's not only these experts, but participants can really represent a range of perspectives or views or beliefs or values found in the kinds of areas that you're looking at. So for instance, if you're designing an REA that is focused on health, participants, the sampling of participants can really range from people who are community leaders or policymakers or change makers. It can also involve health and social service managers and providers. And it can definitely include individuals from affected populations who may need or use these kinds of services. And it can also involve community members who are living in that particular area, which is experiencing an issue as well.
Just as an example, we typically would develop a list of just through our kind of our own research and through discussions as we were doing our planning process, we would develop a list of potential participants. And a lot of times we did some kind of informational phone interviews up front. And then when we got out to the field, would follow up with people. And then also, you know, just through chain referral or we would ask those people who else they thought we should talk to about whatever the particular problem was. But definitely we would want to talk with people who were knowledgeable, quote unquote, or quote unquote knowledgeable about the problem in the sense that they've had, they were not necessarily technical experts, but that they had some experience or had been affected by the problem in some way.
So earlier you mentioned that this is a very team-based approach. And so in your book, you mentioned there are important aspects to the field, including your notes, your field team, and debriefing. So can you briefly explain what those are and how they are separate but also go together?
Sure, I can start on this too. I want to kind of just for those people, for those listeners who may be joining in who may not know what field work means or what the field, you know, how we're sort of characterizing the field. So I want to just kind of not define it, but sort of characterize it a little bit here. So in anthropology, ethnographic field work is sort of the quintessential method, right? in a sense that anthropologists are really defining fieldwork, not so much as a location or a space or even like a geographical kind of characterization, but it's really about wherever, you know, it's the process of actually interacting or gathering information at the site or a location where some cultural sharing group is studied. And so in our work in particular, we're really trying to emphasize that the notion of who shares culture or where these interactions are happening are not necessarily in these traditional ways of thinking about culture as it relates to language, ethnic or religious groups somewhere out there in the world, but rather culture is really defined as sharing beliefs or practices or values. And so culture can also exist as well as the field can actually characterize things other than just communities or a broader sense of what a community might mean in terms of institutions, organizations, as well as disciplines. They also have culture. And so the field can also encompass those things as well. I just wanted to kind of clarify that. And I don't know, Karen, if you want to kind of talk about how important team-based work is.
Yes. So building the team or putting the team together is really something we wanted to write about, because I think, you know, we wanted this book to be very practical. And so, you know, as we went through doing various rapid assessments over the years, you know, I think we can look back at both our successes and some of the challenges we had. The field team is really important. You want it to be multidisciplinary in the best of circumstances, so people with different kinds of training brought to bear on the issue, in part because you're going to be working in a relatively short period of time trying to collect a lot of information. And so there's no one person who can be sort of on top of every issue. So, you know, the field team really needs to be a combination of somebody with basically methods expertise, the kind of qualitative social science expertise that knows how to conduct an interview and can coach other people on the team about how to do that and can do kind of the basic training that needs to be done, that can talk to people the other team members about how to collect field notes and those kinds of things. The cultural expertise is really more about, it may be about the actual kind of more traditional kind of thinking about culture as you're, you know, in the field, somebody from that particular community or ethnic group, but it may also be somebody who the kind of thinking about institutional culture, like a healthcare worker or someone like that who might join the team. Technical expertise is also important, just in terms of you need somebody on the team that really kind of understands in a deeper way, kind of the technical issues around, if you're working with a disease outbreak, the technical issues around disease transmission and treatment. So as an example, on our teams, a lot of time we would take out, we're both qualitative researchers, we would take out, we're anthropologists, we would have a qualitative person on the team, we would have maybe an epidemiologist or a psychologist who was also trained in public health, but we might also have somebody who had actually worked in a state health department and been a disease investigator and knew kind of the technical ins and outs of doing contact tracing and working with providers on treatment issues and those kinds of things. The other aspect that I think I would just touch on briefly is that, you know, it's field work. Doing a rapid assessment and being on a field team is really exciting work, but it's also very intense. So you're out in the field every day doing interviews with people that take a lot of energy in terms of focus and listening. You may be spending, you know, an hour on an interview and then a little bit of a break and going and doing another interview and doing several of those during the day. So you need people who are really kind of flexible and adaptable, who are able to work in that kind of intensive environment. And so that just the being able to be a great team member is also really important, because you can have the smartest, most technically proficient person in the world, but if they're not able to work as a team member, it can be very challenging. So those are just some aspects that we included in the book and wanted people be able to kind of think about as they're doing their planning.
And just to kind of add to that and to emphasize it also from sort of an academic and teaching perspective too, in some ways, is that I think this is the hardest thing that I have to sort of teach. So I also, in teaching ethnographic and qualitative research methods, I've actually taken a team-based approach in helping students think about how to work together to solve these sort of critical contemporary challenges. So I draw on a lot of my own experiences in working in and designing REAs when I was at the CDC to help students really think about, you know, why teamwork is really a structured approach that draws on the power of group interaction to offset some of the challenges that you often have in collecting ethnographic data very quickly. And so this is, I think, one of the hardest things for people to understand who may be very well versed in traditional ethnography or qualitative work. It might also be really critical. It could be really challenging for people who are used to team-based work and other kinds of research methodologies. But as Karen said, the fact that you are doing pretty much, at least in the field, you're pretty much together for most of the day, except maybe when you're sleeping. And so this intensity of the interaction itself can be really challenging for some people. And I think what is really important to understand is that the team-based work occurs at pretty much every stage of the rapid ethnographic process. So from planning to field work to doing regular team debriefings where people are sharing what's being learned and to determine directions of how subsequent data collection might go. Team members are also determining data management and preparation practices. So things like how to secure and store data, tracking data, monitoring data. They're also working on data analysis and interpretation together. And so these qualities in the book, we use the metaphor of a three-legged stool and how each of those components are absolutely necessary. And you can't really work without one in trying to build a team. So some of the things that Karen's already said in terms of methodological expertise, topical expertise, as well as, quote unquote, the cultural expertise aspect of it. But I also just want to emphasize what Karen said, which is that you really need to have people who are adaptable and flexible and who are really team players that can really make or break a team as well.
So analysis is an important part of the REAs and an iterative process. What are some key issues regarding analysis?
What we really try to emphasize, you know, we cover sort of a broad range, but the book is not really focused on data analysis in that sense that we feel that there are excellent materials that are really available on ethnographic and qualitative data analysis, and it was really just impossible or impractical for us to cover all of those various different kinds of approaches. But what we try to do is just to give a basic overview of qualitative data analysis, and sort of focus on some of the key things. We also really focus much more on the team-based aspect of data analysis and how important it is to really sort of think through what that might mean. And so we're really kind of focused on the strategies and practices that are enabling people or the team to actually conduct data analysis very quickly and efficiently, as well as sort of having the time to facilitate more collaboration with local communities and populations to get feedback from them to really sort of strengthen some of the validity of the findings themselves and increasing the chance that the final report and the recommendations actually have value and meaning in the communities themselves.
Yeah, I think one of the things it might be important to just say here is that, you know, we talk about some different examples in the book, but rapid assessments kind of vary in size. And so we've worked on kind of smaller scale assessments that were done, you know, very quickly over the course of a week or 2 weeks. And then we turn around, we have a small team, we go in, we come out, and do the work. And then there are, I've also worked or been involved in rapid assessments that were much bigger, that were multiple sites, you know, much larger teams, took a longer time. And so I think the way that, you know, when you're doing your planning, when you think about kind of the scope and scale of the RAA that you're going to undertake, that also influences, you know, how you're going to handle the analysis. And so, you know, whether you're going to be doing the analysis in one location, or whether you're going to have people working out in other states or other countries, you know, you have to think about things like the connectivity issues and the software issues. Who has the product? Who's actually been trained in it? Are you going to try to do a lot of this manually? Is that even possible? So kind of thinking through those issues before you get started, kind of also, you know, in the planning, thinking about, I mean, that goes back to thinking about the size and the scale and the scope. I've been involved in discussions for some rapid assessments that clearly people wanted to make the project much bigger. And you have to kind of bring people back to the points that, you know, this is really about depth and not breadth, and think about the fact that conducting qualitative analysis under any circumstances can be very labor intensive. So you want people to just be aware of what they're getting to up front and thinking about that.
Sometimes it's also really important to emphasize where data analysis and qualitative work, and especially ethnographic work, is very iterative. And so this is something that can be really hard for people who are not sort of well-versed in those kinds of research traditions to understand, where analysis really occurs in tandem with data collection and really continues until the findings are really reported out. And so it's a much longer process of analysis. You're constantly thinking about things, collecting data, and noticing things all along. So we like to say that analysis begins with the first time you step out into the field, or the first interview, for instance. So it's a much longer iterative process than it is in other types of research. So that's really important to remember. And so we use these things in terms of having a model that has been discussed before, where it's iterative and it's a cyclical process of noticing, collecting, and thinking about information that you're continually seeing and hearing. So paying attention to what's going on, using observation notes, interviews, and other methods, and as well as in debriefing with your team, with team members, collecting information in terms of organizing things that are, you know, hanging together or grouping together. And then also the team looks for patterns and relationships in the data in order to develop some of these concrete types of recommendations, as well as thinking about conclusions. So we do talk about that a lot, but we also, in the book, we find that it's really important for people to understand and not to leave the analysis process so nebulous, but to rather sort of think about the components of analysis that are really important for this type of work. And so we do talk about in the book much more extensively breaking down the components of analysis to sort of four broad kinds of phases, which not phases in a sense that you're really thinking about debriefing and memoing, reducing the data, interpreting the data, and then how to actually represent that data for people to take action on.
Great. To build off of that, you mentioned in your book that the write-ups are an important tool. So what are some key aspects of that users of REAs should keep in mind?
Well, I think that your main considerations for the write-up are going to be the audience and the timeline. So who are you actually writing up? Who are the findings for? Who is the audience for the finding? Is it the funder? Is it a program manager? Is it going to out to a broader community? And there may be very different products that kind of enter into that. But you want to think about, and you want to do this early on, and you want to be able to have some discussions with the organization or the funder about what exactly it is that they're trying to achieve, and When do they actually need those findings? So, what, you know, are they going to be using the findings from a report to inform a budget period or something? So you want to be able to think about that and talk about that ahead of time, because you don't want to have a report come in with lots of great data in it that can't be used for a budget planning period, for example. So you need to determine upfront, you know, who the audience is and what the timeline is, and then think about what are the various products that are going to go to the different audiences. In our work, more often than not, we wrote a report. That was a report that usually ended up being, depending upon the size of the assessment, you know, 25 to 30 pages with findings and recommendations that went to the, in our work with state health departments, went to the state health department, people that we were working with. And then later on, there might be a manuscript, and that's something that can also be discussed up front. But the idea is that this should be done as quickly as possible in order to get the findings out for practical use. So that's kind of a key things to be thinking about initially. In terms of the write-up, there's no one way to write a report. But I don't think one of the things that we tried to always be aware of is, you know, what were the main research questions and the main assessment questions that we were trying to address? And to the degree that we can specifically respond to those, I think that was really important. I bring that up because I think, you know, having as being trained as an anthropologist and going out to the field and, you know, spending a lot of time looking at a lot of interesting things, there are going to be other things that come up during data collection that are going to be of interest to me as a researcher or as an anthropologist, but they may not necessarily be relevant for the problem that is trying to be solved at the time. So that's just something to think about. And that's not to say that important data should be ignored or disregarded, but you just may not be able to cover everything in a report. So I think those are some things to think about. The other issue is recommendations. We always provided recommendations in the report based on the findings. And I will say that, you know, writing recommendations is one of the hardest things I think you do when you're doing a rapid assessment. And there is no kind of perfect way to write recommendations, but I think to the degree that you can write them to try to be actionable and achievable, that is what we always aspired to. And so we write about that. We give some examples about that. We talk about some different ways to craft recommendations and to think about them. It's also recommendations also may sort of be developed for different levels. So we may be writing a report that goes to a state health department, but there may be a recommendation that comes out of the work that really is something that needs to be done at the federal level. So sometimes you have to write recommendations to kind of work at or that are applicable to various levels and kind of think about how to handle those. Thurka, do you have things to add to that?
Yeah, I just want to kind of give more of a personal take here. I think this section in particular, in going through some of the earlier stages of this book where we were writing drafts, the writing up section, I have to say, was the most useful for my students when I gave them key things to read in the book just to see how they thought about it. I know that this was a chapter that was particularly important, and I thought it would be because writing up in terms of rapid ethnographic assessment, for me at least personally, has been really the hardest thing and the most sort of challenging thing to really think through. I'm still in the process of learning how to write strong recommendations. So as someone who's trained in traditional anthropology, in both cultural and medical anthropology, writing recommendations is not something that you do or are ever trained in. Second, as someone who's also trained in epidemiology and quantitative research, recommendations look very different. And much of it is about how more research really needs to be done. And that's really the extent of it. And so even coming from two different kinds of research kind of trajectories, I feel like a lot of what I learned about writing recommendations, I literally learned when I was working with Karen. And I want to be humble here because I think writing recommendation is really not only a science, it's a really delicate art form. And at the very beginning, when I started doing this work, I would write recommendations, things like, well, we just need to eliminate poverty or everyone just deserves healthcare, right? And, it's really interesting because that's exactly where my mind would go, is that there are all of these really huge structural social issues that we need to really take action on. And I think, it's taken me a long time and I still struggle with this, is to get people to pay attention to you, and not to you, but to the report, and to really sort of make a difference. You know, what Karen's taught me is that you really need to start with some low-hanging fruit. And that's not to diminish those. Some of those low-hanging fruits are really critically important to changing things. And so there are different kind of scales. There are different ways to do this. And we do discuss that in the book itself. And it's been really, again, I'm still someone, even with 22 years of experience, I'm still learning how to write recommendations effectively. And I still sort of struggle with this in teaching students how to do that.
Great. Thank you. So I really enjoyed the use of examples in your book. So I was hoping you could provide us with one case study that really illustrates what you've covered.
Sure. So I'll start here. So I want to use one of the case studies that we use in the book was a rapid ethnographic assessment that we did that focused on HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, sex work, and Latino migrant men in North Carolina. And so this work came about because during the time that I was there, the CDC, as well as our division, received reports from several southern states, including North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, that indicated that female sex workers were moving or being transported throughout the U.S. Southeast. These reports also corresponded with some studies that were coming out that indicated that Latino migrant men, a population that's also highly mobile, were engaging in sex with female sex workers while they were in the United States. And so what we did was we planned an exploratory rapid ethnographic assessment that was collaboration between North Carolina's Division of Public Health, as well as our division at the CDC. And the purpose was to really understand what was going on in terms of the organization and the topology of sex work in some of the selected areas of the state that we thought was important, to really understand sort of the geographic mobility patterns among female sex workers that we were hearing about, but really didn't know too much in-depth information about what those patterns look like. And at least from a public health point of view, it's also about really sort of understanding the potential for increased transmission of HIV as well as sexually transmitted diseases among not only these two populations, but how they might be transmissible to the broader population. And so the findings were really specifically meant to inform the state's existing HIV and STD prevention efforts. The assessment took place over 1 week. So the field work was really 1 week in length, meaning 5 business days. This occurred in May 2010. The team consisted of 4 public health professionals, including Karen and I, Karen and me. And over 5 days, we actually, again, speaking to the intensity of the field work, we conducted 28 interviews with people who had knowledge of contact with migrant laborers, as well as female sex workers in the targeted areas. This included a variety of different people from those who worked in community-based organizations, state and county level staff, as well as legal services or law enforcement staff. We also conducted field observations when we could, especially at places where sex work, we were told, reportedly took place. We also traveled to some migrant camps and spoke informally with two groups of migrant men about sex workers who visited the camp. We weren't able to make contact with female sex workers, which wasn't unexpected. Few of our contacts were actually engaging with sex workers for a variety of different reasons, and we just couldn't also make that work during that five-day time period. And so in terms of timeline, from the time of field work to actually reporting out the final recommendations, it took about 6 months. And the findings really resulted in useful information about the things that we were looking for. So the organization and topology of sex work in the area, the mobility among various sectors of the sex work industry. It also helped, our findings also helped program staff and organizations working with Latino migrant men better understand what we theorize as sort of the geography of sex work, where and in what types of venues sex workers were making contact with men, and why the potential for risk, especially with HIV and STDs, may be higher in some population than others. We found that sex work services were very diverse and widely available, and the interactions among sex workers and clients weren't random at all, but very structured by the type of venues and the work environments that actually really had a critical sort of influence in shaping the interaction. And that we also found that sexual networking was much more of a function of different kinds of social, cultural, economic, and other kinds of factors, like physical space or location, proximity and availability of sex partners, and venues and locations that were often used to find sex partners. And I think the most critical thing here was also that we found that there was a severe lack of HIV and STD prevention care, as well as treatment services for both of these populations who were already highly vulnerable. That was also another key finding that we wanted to really sort of change the nature of the kinds of care that were available to people. So Karen, I don't know if you have.
I just would say a little bit about the follow-up to that. And we in the book include three different case studies, all of which have also had papers published in peer-reviewed journals, so that people can actually look at those as well. But that all three of these have resulted in some follow-up activities. You know, so in the case of North Carolina, for example, we then went back and did a town hall meeting with stakeholders and presented the findings to the state health department partners in the community. And there, that was an opportunity for people to actually meet, ask questions, and talk with each other about potential strategies for reaching sex workers and their Latino male clients. We provided some feedback to the state in terms of recommendations for where they might, you know, start to strengthen programs or do some outreach. I think one of the things that became apparent just through that bit of work was that there was some outreach going on, but it was mainly taking place in formal kind of H2A legal camps where men who were in the United States legally or had legal documentation were being housed, but that they were missing a lot of men who were working in North Carolina who were perhaps not documented and didn't have adequate housing. So it's, you know, it's a much more hidden population. And so I think thinking, you know, they were thinking more about how to reach some of those people. But in the book, we, in all three case studies, we kind of walk through some of the activities that then resulted as or that came out of the findings of the rapid assessment. Some of the additional steps that were taken to either try to put programs in place or develop programs or do cross training or change things or eliminate some problems within the health system. And so a lot of times these, you know, these may seem like kind of small steps. You know, we're not eliminating poverty or HIV or STDs, but trying to help fine tune programs to reach people to be able to make some improvements in terms of responding to disease outbreaks.
Great, thank you. So if you had to give a brief takeaway from the book, what would you tell our listeners today?
I think, you know, I would really like to see one of the reasons I, you know, got involved in with Thurka in writing this book is that I would really like to see more people take up the tool. I think that, you know, rapid assessment is really a complementary tool to a lot of other things that are out there. And it's not just in public health, it's in other fields as well. And it's something that I think people can actually learn how to do and then teach others. And so it's not just a tool that it, you know, is only available to someone with a PhD in anthropology or an epidemiologist with year or a medical, you know, a medical doctor with lots of training in epidemiology. I think we did most of our work in government, but to think about, you know, how that work can be disseminated and used by people in non-government and community-based organizations or within communities, in any place where we need to be engaging with local communities and encouraging more participation. And I think that that's what I would, I think there are, we've seen benefits from the work that we've done. We've seen real change. And I think that the more that we can kind of get it out there as a complementary tool, I think that is what I would hope to achieve with the book.
I think for me, I think that this is really a method for the current moment. So given that we are really increasingly living in environments where there are lots of shifts in social sort of context or political context, I really think that rapid ethnographic assessment can help researchers and communities really quickly act on some of these really critical challenges that are affecting people today. And I think in the book that we're really trying to kind of share with other people what we've learned, and not just anthropologists or public health researchers, but anyone who's really interested or committed to engaging communities to develop programs and policies that really respond to some of these challenges that we're facing today. And I also want to say that this isn't just, I want to reiterate and really emphasize what Karen said, that you don't need to be formally trained in research. These are definitely tools that communities can take upon themselves as well, in conjunction with others who may be able to help them fashion this kind of work. And we really also wrote the book knowing that these can be critical tools for those outside of North American and European research sites, that these are also kinds of research strategies that people around the world can also sort of employ. And it's really about, at least for me, taking ethnographic research out of the academy and out of really sort of formal research structures, and to kind of democratize research more broadly. For me, that's sort of the ideal. I also think that rapid ethnographic assessments are great teaching tools within the academy as well. I think students really respond to this method. I think they really want to have a set of skills that they can think about and how to really do work that's meaningful and that gives something back rather than to create sort of additional knowledge, which is also a really important aspect of it. I'm not trying to diminish that, but I think students are also really drawn to something that can have critical engagement. I also, my classes are also filled with non-anthropology students. So this is also something that isn't specific to anthropology. I think that many students who are coming from public health, international relations, I've had students from journalism, education, sociology, urban planning. So this is such an important method for a variety of different kinds of disciplines as well.
So today I've been talking with Thurka Sangamoorthy and Karen Kroger about their new book, Rapid Ethnographic Assessments, a practical approach and toolkit for collaborative community research. So what are you all working on now?
I think Karen has something really exciting potentially happening.
Well, I don't know. I think right now we're all working on just figuring out the next few months, given the pandemic that we're in. But I was recently accepted for to the Fulbright specialist roster. So thank you. Yeah. So hopefully I'll be on the roster for 3 years, and hopefully there'll be some interesting activities coming my way. I'm no longer at CDC. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but I retired from CDC at the end of 2017. And so I'm looking for other interesting projects to help out with.
So Karen was really, I think, very generous to spend some of her retirement time writing this with me. As for me, I'm really, you know, in terms of my academic work, I'm working on two other projects. One is a book project that hopefully will come to fruition in the next year around the longstanding work that I've done on immigration and rural healthcare and rural healthcare systems. So that's one project. And the second project, you know, has been years in the making, which is my HIV work. And I'm really kind of doing something a little bit new around oral histories, working with collecting oral histories, as well as doing portraits. I'm not the photographer, which is a good thing. Working with a photographer to really do some portraits of the women, and this is really sort of a commentary on aging and living with HIV as a Black woman in the DC area. And I'm working to do something that's not an academic publication from that, and also thinking about archival work and trying to kind of preserve some of these voices that I think are really desperately needed, and thinking about the history of HIV. And then also trying to think about more of a national storytelling campaign around voices that are often left out of that.
Well, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much, Sarah.